Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, a viewer's guide to the first presidential debate, what to look and listen for on Monday night, what the candidates should say but won't, how to survive the post-debate spin. And as we talk, I think it would be interesting to hear from you via social media. Do the debates have the potential to change your mind about a specific candidate for president? What's the question you would ask if you were there? So as we talk about the presidential debates, I'm thinking of this as a viewer's guide. I want to hear from you about whether something that the presidential candidates would say in the debate has the potential to change your mind. And what's the question you would ask if you were asking some of the questions? On social media, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Jorge Saavedra is founder of the Saavedra Law Firm in Minneapolis. Welcome. Good to have you in the roundtable.
Good morning, Carrie.
Nosheema Hussain is co-founder and executive director of RISE. It's an Islamic empowerment group for women. She was also at her first National Democratic Convention. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie.
And Peter Bell is former chair of the Met Council and senior fellow at the Center of the American Experiment. Welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Jorge, will you watch these debates anticipating that you're going to get some kind of clarity on specific issues from the candidates, or are they really more about political theater for you? What are you looking for?
Yeah, well, I've spent the entire campaign looking for clarity.
How's that going?
From the very beginning, and astonishment, I think, is what I get more than clarity. So, yeah, I'll be watching the debates carefully and trying to see how or what we can learn about both candidates, because I think there's questions about both of them for the American voter right now.
What's the biggest? So when you say you're looking for clarity, what's the biggest mystery to you right now about some position they hold or what they would do? What would you say to that?
The thing that I keep coming back to, and I have a lot of issues to talk about, but the one that I keep coming back to is when are journalists going to be able to punch through on Donald Trump, mm-hmm. and press him for good answers on so many of the questions that he's raised with everything he's been saying on the campaign trail?
Yeah, Nosheema, I saw you nodding as Jorge was saying that. That's one of the big issues for you?
Yeah, I have to agree with Jorge. Not having a clear understanding of what his policies are and how he's going to make America great again is, I think, what I'm struggling with, too.
Yeah. So, Peter, is that I think this is one of the things that where there's a lot of expectation and tension around the journalists who are going to be moderating the debates. As Jorge says, can they punch through a lot of the kind of stream of consciousness answers to questions and give some kind of clarity about what he really thinks? What's your sense?
Yeah, I guess I say yes and no to that. Let me go back to your original question and then get to that specific one.
Okay.
I will be watching it intensely. I think 100 million people are going to be looking at it. And I think the goals of each candidate are different. Trump's are to look presidential, mm-hmm. much like Reagan had to do, that he wasn't just an actor and the like. And Clinton, I think, really has to have, in some respects, a clear articulation of what it is that she wants to do, other than be the third term of Barack Obama. I think that, and more in a visionary sense, rather than a position paper kind of response. I take issue slightly with what folks said about reporters need to break through with Trump. Because I think many of the supporters of Trump know that many of the statements, the outrageous, outlandish statements that he makes, the statements that simply aren't true, I don't think that his supporters really think that if he builds a wall, that the Mexican government would pay for it, or that he would deport all 11 million illegal. I don't think his supporters
If they don't believe it, why isn't it still incumbent on journalists to say, this is your position, how do you get it done? Why do you keep saying things that look-alike they are going to be impossible to carry out.
Because I think that he is, someone said that a lot of politics is dog whistles, you know, signals that mm-hmm. are being sent out. And I think Trump is doing kind of a wolf's growl. It's much more than a dog whistle. But I think that these are signals that he is sending, and that that his followers are picking up on the signals, but not on the specifics. And when people say to Trump, when he says something I think is outrageous, like not only building a wall, but that he's going to have the Mexican government pay for it, and the press says, well, wait a minute, now you said it was going to be $12 billion. It's really going to be $26 billion. They've missed the point. He is signaling, I think, the country and the supporters a position and a direction.
I think
he
you
wants
can
to go.
Know that and acknowledge the signal and still ask for the details. Jorge Nishino, what do you think?
Exactly. I mean, I think that I agree with some of what Peter is saying here in terms of, you know, this. He's communicating to a specific base of supporters. But I think it still it doesn't relieve any of us about asking the hard questions and getting specific answers. Especially, you know, one of the things that that I keep coming back to is that when Donald Trump talks about immigration and he talks about immigrants, he's talking about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I want answers about the things that he's proposing about me and my community. You know, these things that I think, if you're not concerned about immigration, if it's not a personal issue to you, maybe you can look at that and put it in a political context that's abstract and, you know, once removed from yourself. But I look at him and I think, you know, this guy is targeting me. And in this situation, you know, sort of the fight or flight response is what I think I frequently get.
When you hear him say something that you think, this is personal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely, deeply personal. You know, and I live in a mixed-status family, a mixed-status community, and as an immigration lawyer working with immigrants, Latino immigrants in particular, day in and day out, I see, you know, the way that this comes home and the immigrant experience of Minnesota very close up. And so for me, I'm not satisfied with sort of, you know, the context of this is just political rhetoric.
Right. Let me go back to Peter and then to Nishino about that. So, Peter, to Jorge's point on this, this is not just political theater. He is, even though he's sending signals to his supporters, he's saying larger things that mean something pretty personal to voters.
Well, I think that that's true. I don't know that Trump, to be blunt, is going after Jorge's vote. And I think that he is signaling, I think that reporters, the press, and the public that want to pin Trump down on his outrageous lies are barking up the wrong tree. I think Trump and Clinton really are kind of battling what the definition of citizenship is in kind of a, you know, Clinton's term stronger together is kind of a we're all in it together, you know, not quite world citizen, but, you know, it kind of has that feel or flavor or tone to it. And Trump is much more nationalistic, mm-hmm. much more, you know, we've got to look after ourselves. We've got to focus on ourselves. Now, what does ourselves mean is a question. But they're kind right. of battling, I think, at a very high level, what the definition of it means to be a citizen. How much assimilation or acculturation should be expected from people who come into this country is a very important. What are the benefits and drawbacks from celebrating or focusing on diversity? I personally think there are many benefits to it, but there's some drawbacks to it as well. And I think that that battle is being fought on a very high level, and each candidate is sending signals.
Yeah, Nishina?
So I think similar to what Jorge was saying on when Trump says things like banning Muslims from entering the country, you know, America is built on immigrants. And so when I think about if I leave the country and come back in, will I be able to come back in, even though I was born and raised here and I'm an American?
Mm-hmm.
And then second is that the rhetoric is now not just at this national level, but it's trickling down into our communities in the form of discrimination and hate and violence. So, you know, Muslims are being attacked because they are visibly wearing their traditional garb. And that, I feel like the rhetoric has given people this free pass that they can shout vulgarities. And then when it escalates, you know, people are being shot at and being harassed and violently abused. And so...
And are you saying you think Trump has to be accountable for the consequences of that kind of rhetoric?
Well, his rhetoric is, you know, there's a fine line between exercising your freedom of speech, but then when you start to take that to that next level of hate speech, which then turns into discriminatory actions, mm-hmm. I think you've crossed the line there. And so that's what I think people need to be accountable for, is that you have the right to your opinion, but how you manifest that is really what's at stake here.
I saw your reaction, Jorge, when Peter said it's being fought at a very high level.
Yeah.
And I kind of had a similar his assertions, Peter, seem so thin. I mean, they're not fleshed out actual policy positions. So I don't know if it's being fought at a high level.
Yeah, and I don't think it is. I don't think there's anything high level about it. I think this is, this is playground down in the gutter, the way that he's talking about it. And there's nothing sophisticated about his political messaging in terms of, I don't think there's a dog whistle here. And if there is a dog whistle, it's the one that crosses the line into, you know, inciting sort of violence. And so I think there's a real danger. And so this question of accountability, I think, is a real one for us when we're thinking about the presidency. And one of the concerns that I have, you know, that I think goes beyond this question is this eroding respect that we have for the office.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have a presidential candidate who's endorsed by a major party who is actively promoting the erosion of the office. And I think that we start to tread into something dangerous. I really do believe, you know, from a First Amendment standpoint, that there is wide latitude for us to argue and discuss and do so as forcefully as we possibly can. But I think we have to be respectful of a system that's worked very well for, a few hundred years. You know, and I come from a country where after 140 years of democracy, we lost democracy to a military dictatorship. And so to me, these things have real meaning. It's not an abstract thing in terms of, if you start to chip away at the foundations of some of these institutions and the rule of law, an especially important one that it seems to me Donald Trump is actively attacking, then I think we start to get into some really unfirm territory.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable that I'm thinking about as kind of a viewer's guide for the first presidential debate that's coming up on Monday. What to look for, what to listen for, what the candidates should say but won't, what the moderators should ask but won't, how to survive the post-debate spin. And asking you, as you listen to our conversation, do the debates have the potential really to change your mind about a candidate? And what's the question you would ask if you were asking some of the questions? You can tweet me at Kerri, KerriMPR. Our roundtablers today, Peter Bell, senior fellow at the Center for the American Experiment, Nashina Hussain, co-founder and executive director of RISE, and Jorge Saavedra, founder of the Saavedra Law Firm. Can I bring this back to, we were kind of talking about the rhythms, I guess, and some of the rhetoric of the campaign. Let me bring it back specifically to the debate. And Peter, I had a discussion with Ken Rudin earlier this week about whether the moderators should be fact-checking in real time, because there's been a lot of speculation. What are we going to do if Trump says things that are patently not true? I mean, you said you think he tells lies. So this is Ken.
I do.
You do think that, right?
Yes, I do.
Can I second that?
Yeah. So Ken said that he was talking to longtime CBS journalist Bob Schieffer about it, and this is what Schieffer said.
You just want to tell people and help people understand who these people are. And the most important thing that the moderator can remember, I think, is that we're not electing a moderator. We're electing a president of the United States. And I think if you kind of take that as your guiding philosophy, I think you'll get closer to performing a real service for the American people.
He was suggesting, as Chris Wallace has, that it is not the job of the moderator to be the fact checker. That draws too much attention to the journalist moderating the debate. What do you think?
I agree that the moderator should not be the fact checker, but for different reasons. One is, I don't think the moderator should get into arguments with the people that are debating. And if you do that, that's apt to happen. And I don't think you also want a moderator to get into gotcha kind of things. Wait a minute, that's not quite right. Mm-hmm. A wall wouldn't cost $12 billion. It would cost $13.5 billion. And, you know, you would have to, if you're going to deport everyone, it's the budget, how are you going to pay for it? That kind of thing, I think, goes over people's head and makes people irritated. And so I would not do that. I would show where he and Mrs. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, are in error with their facts.
Okay.
And I would challenge them on that. But I wouldn't push that very, very hard, because I think it creates a dynamic that is not helpful. I just want to clarify one thing. When I say Trump is talking at a 30,000-foot level or sending signals, I don't mean in a refined sense at all. I just think that he wants people – Clinton's major issue, I think, is nobody knows why she wants to be president, and no one really knows what she wants to do. And she'll say, well, go on our webpage, and we have all these position papers. I disagree that people don't know what Trump wants to do. I think people do know what Trump mm-hmm. wants to do in a really broad, general sense. And I don't think people are confused by it. I don't think the three of us are confused by
it. I'm confused by it. I'm confused about how he's going to build the wall that he's been talking about.
That's a how.
Well, no, I know why.
Well, but that's what the public...
Well, I think the how is part of the understanding how you're going to govern, isn't it?
And we might just disagree that the public really wants to know, in a broad sense, in broad directional sense, where are you going to take the country?
Yeah.
And the details of it, I think the public, one, isn't interested in, can't follow, and doesn't believe. You can have a position paper, and they just say, you're not going to be able to do that.
Right.
There's going to be a thing. But they want to know directionally where you're going to take the country. I think people know directionally where Trump's going to take the country. And I think I would agree with my two panelists that that frightens me. Probably not as much as the two of them, but it frightens me. I'm not sure where Hillary Clinton is going to take the country.
Okay,
I just don't know.
To that point.
So the one thing I have to agree with Peter is that as a woman, I think everybody kind of assumes that I'm with her, and I'm not there yet, to be honest. So that's probably one of the main reasons I want to watch the debates is, will I get some clarity on where she stands on some of these positions? I can't relate to her yet. I don't think she has experienced the same things I have. I don't know if she can relate to women of color, those of different religions, of different ethnicities. So I want to be very clear on, it's wonderful that a woman is the presidential nominee, but I also want to understand what her policies are and where she stands on them and if they align with my values.
So you are one of those voters who the debates could actually give you clarity and could, I sense you're not going to vote for Trump, but could change your mind about being enthusiastic potentially for Hillary Clinton.
I mean, and for, you know, complete transparency, I went to the DNC as a Bernie Sanders delegate.
And so, figured that.
So,
once I heard this.
Right. So, now that she is a nominee, we want to ensure that the policies that we stood behind Bernie Sanders campaign are implemented in hers and that, you know, she is able to take the voice of all those other millions of supporters and be able to win them over into how she wants to govern. And I think that's where I'm still on the fence, is I'm not sure if I'm over that fence yet.
Yeah. Jorge, on the fact checking and kind of what Peter says is well, there's more clarity there than you think. It's directional instead of specific, and that's enough.
I just think that an effective moderator should have good follow-up questions,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think, maybe an argument is not the goal here as much as I think it is, again, pressing. And I think, moving beyond the 30,000-foot view on some of these things that I think are just so astonishing, the ban on Muslims. How exactly are
but
you
Peter
going to
says
do
we
that?
We shouldn't ask how.
Yeah. No,
but
I'm
I think.
Just,
the, but well, in this case, the how is so important, and I think it really implicates a question that I think is so important for the presidency, which is the Constitution. And so here, I think fundamentally, you have somebody who is proposing some very frightening things about how do we identify the Muslims, and then what exactly is that purity test that's going to take place at the border? What exactly is going to be the process of vetting people? I think last night Trump said that these terrorist attacks in Minnesota and in New Jersey, New York, were due to our open immigration system.
Mm-hmm.
When the authorities have yet to establish and provide details about the immigration history for these individuals. So how are we making these links? And that, to me, really crosses the line in terms of someone who's commander-in-chief and has incredible powers as the president of the United States gets us into some, we're heading, I think, towards some things that if Trump were to become president and these things become actionable, what do they look like? We absolutely should be asking those questions right now.
Peter?
I don't disagree with Jorge that we shouldn't be asking them. I'm just saying the belief that that's going to move the needle is very much overstated. What I think most Trump supporters today know that we're not going to deport 11 million folks. If you ask them, are we going to deport 11 million folks, they would say, well, no.
I disagree with that.
Yeah, me too.
Well,
I disagree with that.
Incidentally, the polls really show that many, if you ask Trump supporters, is Mexico going to pay for the wall?
Well, that's
they say no.
But the deportation thing.
The polls I have seen, when you say, if you ask Trump voters, are we going to deport 11 million folks, the trouble that I have with what Hora is saying is that reconciliation of two things. I think most Americans, including Trump supporters, knows that he makes outrageous statements that aren't true, and he's rising in the polls. And so my two colleagues have to reconcile those two things.
But I don't think that most Trump supporters believe everything he says isn't true, and I think they want to believe some of what he says is true.
What they believe is that immigration will be tougher under Trump, and that they want immigration tougher. And I think that that's really what they believe.
Okay, so you don't think that they believe that there will be a test for Muslims that want to come in to the United States under Donald Trump? Not that he's going to deport everybody, but new Muslim immigrants, that there will be a test for that he will stop that? I absolutely believe that he'd try to do that.
I think the vast majority of Trump supporters don't know that. Don't know that that point.
Okay.
And wouldn't see it as a directional statement more than a specific one.
What do you two want to say to this?
I think the thing that really got my attention about what Peter said is this, suggestion that there's a disconnect between, maybe what I'm perceiving about Donald Trump and what he's saying and my desire to get some clarity on that and the fact that he's rising in the polls. I don't think that these things are inconsistent at all. And in fact, that goes to the reason why these questions are so important,
mm-hmm.
because here we have somebody who's making these outlandish, over-the-top, frequently false statements and statements that are in contradiction with the law and the Constitution. And he has a growing base of supporters. That, to me, is ultimately the dangerous thing, in that here we have someone who may very well become president. He has a pathway to do that. And he's been emboldened by this growing support.
Now, Sheena?
I'm laughing because Peter's shaking his head. No, not a chance.
I'm just saying that. I hope so. I don't think he's going to be president.
Yeah. Yes, I hope not. But I think the reason he's rising in the polls is I think people really believe what he's saying, and they share those same views, the racist views, the bigoted statements. I think, unfortunately, this this has been festering in people's hearts and minds, and now it has a vocal loudspeaker attached to it in the form of a presidential candidate.
I've had this conversation with people, and I just want to bounce off of what Nashina said, which is that, you know, he has emboldened people, and what people I think maybe had in their hearts now is out in the open. And what I'm responding to is people saying that, and I'm saying, no, this has been here all along.
Well, so this is the question I want you all to think about: is as we watch the debates, are we learning as much about ourselves as citizens, as an electorate, as American voters, as we're learning about them? So think about that. This is the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation, kind of a viewer and listener guide to the upcoming first presidential debate on Monday. We're talking about some of the issues that will come up in the debate, how to watch and hear what the candidates are asked and say, and some of that post-debate spin. We'll talk a little bit about that. Jorge Saavedra with us, Nashina Hussain, and Peter Bell with us. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our Friday Roundtable.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom. The Tulsa, Oklahoma police officer charged with killing an unarmed black motorist has turned herself in to authorities. Officer Betty Shelby was then released early this morning on a $50,000 bond. Shelby has been charged with first-degree manslaughter for shooting and killing 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher. Prosecutors say Shelby reacted unreasonably when she shot Crutcher, who was listening to police commands and walking away from her at the time. A midnight to 6 a.m. curfew will be in effect in Charlotte, North Carolina, until a state of emergency has been lifted. Following two nights of protests that led to violence, Charlotte's mayor ordered the curfew last night, telling civilians that they needed to be off the streets at midnight. Many protesters are disputing a police account that 43-year-old Keith Scott had a gun in his hand when he was fatally shot by a police officer earlier this week. President Obama says recent fatal shootings of blacks by police should be a source of concern for all Americans. In an interview on ABC, Obama declined to address specific cases. Obama said protesters expressing their frustrations by looting are not going to advance the cause of racial justice. A Syrian military official says airstrikes and shelling in the northern city of Aleppo might continue for an extended period and will include a ground offensive. The military announcement came as a bombing campaign in rebel-held districts of Aleppo intensified today. Diplomatic efforts failed to salvage a ceasefire that lasted nearly a week before giving way to a new level of violence. And dozens of bodies are being pulled out of the waters off the coast of Rosetta, Egypt, 3 days after hundreds of migrants heading to Europe drowned when their overcrowded boat capsized. The UN's Migration Watcher puts the death toll at 51, but says that figure is expected to rise considerably. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:36.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
I'm Carrie Miller. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable as we look ahead to Monday's first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And we've asked a group of roundtablers to come in and kind of provide a little bit of insight, something to look for, something to listen for as the debate gets underway, some of the spin that's going to follow the debate, some of the questions that we wish the moderator would ask, some of the questions the moderator will ask. Jorge Saavedra with us this morning. He's the founder of the Saavedra Law Firm. Nashina Hussain, co-founder, executive director of RISE. It's an Islamic empowerment group for women. And Peter Bell, senior fellow at the Center for the American experiment. Okay, the question that I raised going into the news break there was, are we learning and will the debates even emphasize this more? Are we learning more about ourselves as American voters, the character maybe of the American electorate, than maybe we thought we would? Nashina, I'm gonna come to you first on that. What do you think?
Absolutely, yes. Especially when I think about our Minnesota nice, mm-hmm. and how we don't exactly share what's on our minds. And this election, you know, these past 12 to 18 months have really put some of us on the spot to be able to articulate exactly what we're thinking. So I think, I mean, there's a healthy balance between what we want and what we're thinking, and making sure that there's equity in what we're asking.
Okay. Can I?
Yeah, Peter.
I think that's a very good question. Or what are we learning about ourselves? And one of the things I think we are learning is the nation's regrettable tolerance for outrage and outrageous statements and outrageous candidates. And I think that's, you know, this isn't spin. This isn't kind of shading the truth. These are things that are being said that simply aren't true. Second thing I think we're learning about ourselves is that, and I've heard that a lot of people talking about this, but the political parties may be reconstituting themselves along class and deeper racial lines and education lines, that if you're college educated, Black, Hispanic, or Muslim, you'll lean toward Democrat. If you're white and don't have a college education or poor, you'll lean toward Republican. That's a division that America really hasn't had. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is how outsiders are really taking over the political process, you know, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. You know, these are very, or Ted Cruz, you know, these are very forceful candidates, and they were totally from the outside and really wanted to be very disruptive in our political process. It wasn't incremental change. It is disruptive change that they're talking about. Those are three important things I think we're learning about
ourselves.
Jorge,
what do you think we're learning about ourselves? And that may be emphasized during the series of debates.
One of the things that we've had this 2-year period here where I think that we've drawn these bright lines have emerged between race, racial groups, religion, as Peter indicates, you know, sort of the income and education. And those things are, I think, are really stark now in a way where I think for a long time we lived with this idea that as a nation we were getting better at these things. We were getting more colorblind and we were, you know, we were all starting to get along. But you know, there's always been this constant voice that says, well, that's not true. And I think now everyone can see that it's not true, that we have some real deep divisions in that in this political environment that we have right now, people are willing to come out and say so. And that, I think, is one of the things that we've learned is the true state of race and religion and the divisions that divide us. And that, to me, I think, is going to be the tallest order for the next president. That's certainly a question that I have about, for Hillary Clinton, should she take the Oval Office, and I anticipate that she will. But is how do we then govern? How does she govern? And how do we get back to creating policy and moving the nation
that
ahead?
Go anywhere, right, through Congress.
We have some deep wounds that are, not getting any better right now.
And Peter, you brought this up, and I have actually talked about this quite a bit on the program through the election season, and that's the vilification of Trump supporters. When people call to say they are all, I like to kind of gently interrupt to say, I don't think that's true. We can't generalize. But you're concerned about the after effect of the vilification as somebody tries to govern the country.
I really am. I think the people that feel lost in this country, oftentimes, to be blunt, are middle to lower class whites, haven't a college education, probably their IQ's 90 or 100. They're struggling in a lot of different ways. They're not represented on this panel. You know, mm-hmm. we have somebody from the Islamic community on this panel, somebody from the Hispanic community mm-hmm. on this panel. I'm an African-American and often associated with conservatives.
And all but, successful, all college educated, yes, yeah. successful
but,
people
but,
on the panel. It's a good
point.
There's
a whole group of folks that feel, I think, unrepresented and get, and they know that they're not represented and feel somewhat vilified. Mm. And I think, you know, Jorge made an interesting point. I think both the left and the right have misplayed race in this country. I think that the left with celebrating diversity, rather than our common core humanity, mm-hmm. which is what I was always taught was the key to racial reconciliation, is not to talk about how we're different and to celebrate it, but to say we've got much more in common than we do different, and let's celebrate.
Well, I think President Obama said a lot about that,
but the whole focus has been on differences and allowing people to be different and celebrating that rather than the core humanity. And I think the right, quite bluntly, has been just very insensitive to issues of race and the struggles that different racial groups have had and immigrants have had, and have basically turned a blind eye to it. And I really criticize that. So from my vantage point, I think both sides need to take a step back from those two polls.
And I have a different take on that. And, I think what Peter is saying, that, you know, sort of this group of the vilified, you know, the mm-hmm. Sort of low-income whites with, less education and so on. You know, the status, I think, of the middle class in America, it's not the exclusive to any one race. I think there's been an erosion of individual incomes. We still, I think, are in a period of recovery. And I don't think it's exclusive to whites. I think that we share this. But what has happened in this election is that, Donald Trump in particular has drawn divisions among these groups that have all these economic problems in common. And made those divisions about race and about religion. And that's false. And I think that's the challenge, where I think we've tainted the water in terms of what the real policy and social discussion should be about, which is we have some serious economic problems. We have a dramatic shift in terms of how people can earn a living in this country based on our historical past in terms of how we used to do it, making things, and now we're mm-hmm. in a different place. But that is a problem that crosses racial, economic, ethnic, and religious lines. But we are not having that argument in terms of the issue. We're having it in terms of pitting right. one group against another, and that's dangerous.
This is why I think the question about the economy and opportunity is I hope they are pointed and they channel kind of what
but
you guys have said.
Let me respond very quickly to what Jorge says in partial disagreement. I think for immigrants into this country, to some extent the African-American community, there's a sense of hope and possibility that the tomorrow will be better than today. Even if their income is exactly the same as low or middle-income whites.
Uh-huh.
I think with many middle-income whites, they think that their prospects are getting worse.
Yes.
And so it's not what is the income level of the respective groups, because they might be the same. But it is the view of the future and the hope and the possibility, I think, differs very significantly amongst different groups. And that reflects in their political.
This is kind of why I was saying I think those pointed questions about economic opportunity that are complex. Nashina, what would you say?
Well, so just to talk a little bit about this vilifying of supporters, because I don't think that's just limited to the Democratic Party vilifying Trump supporters. I think there's also people within the Democratic Party that are vilifying, supporters of Bernie Sanders or Jill Stein or, you know, supporters of Gary Johnson. So this vilification, I think, is an equal opportunity and is across mm-hmm. the board. Second was, I also don't feel that Trump supporters are this one type of stereotype. I think there are educated people on that side. I think there are people who are at a very high socioeconomic status, and they are the ones who are showing up, who showed up in the primaries, who showed up to caucus, who have helped Trump rise to where he's at. So I just don't think it's a one size fits all when we're stereotyping.
I partially agree and disagree. Trump only got about 12% of the national vote primaries. And I think it was a very somewhat narrow slice. But I do think that even though I think it's a narrow slice, I don't think it's homogeneic. I think you're right. I think it is more than that kind of stereotypic group is portrayed.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We're talking about some of the themes and ideas that have been out there in the stream as we get to, I think, the final weeks of the campaign, coming up on that first debate on Monday, on the presidential debate. And we're talking about some of those ideas and questions that will be asked of the candidates at the debate. And this is where I want to turn to you three and ask for, you're sitting at the moderator's table, Jorge, I'll come to you first. What's one of the, you have an opportunity to ask maybe just one question that night. What would it be?
I think one of the questions that a lot of people have been thinking about to ask Donald Trump is, what happened to Melania Trump? Where has she gone since the, where has she disappeared to since the convention?
Oh my gosh. All right.
But seriously, I have, you know, in terms of Hillary Clinton, I do want to hear, I'd like to get her a take on, you know, I think she has some explaining to do about this issue about transparency.
Okay.
And I'd like to for her to have an opportunity to talk about that.
So, but how would you phrase that in a question? Because here's the other thing. When voters stand up and ask questions, the candidates feel much, much more beholden, I think, to answer as transparently as they should,
yeah,
than when a moderator asks. So you're a voter and you want to know something about transparency. Well, how would you ask?
I think my question would be about how can voters have confidence in your transparency when we've observed that your campaign at times has not been transparent. For example, your recent bout with was it pneumonia?
Yeah, so that troubles you, the way the campaign handled it.
Absolutely, it does, and I think because I think transparency in a time when secrecy has become more and more important, in that you know, we have a government that is more and more secretive, especially in the war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that. I'd like to see the pendulum swing the other way towards transparency, and starting with the president.
Now, Sheena, what would your question be? The one question you get to ask of the candidates that night.
My one question would be, every time we hear about Muslims or Islam in the media, it's always in the context of terrorism. And so how will either candidate help change that narrative about Muslim Americans and the good that they do for our country?
Mm-hmm. What kind of an answer do you think you'd get to that?
It'll probably be fluffy, but, you know, I
what
want...
What kind of an answer should they give
like,
you?
I really want them to give me, like, concrete examples of where they see Muslims and Muslim community serving and protecting and contributing to America and America's history. And I just feel like a lot of it's kind of lip service right now. And I want to see actual.
You want one of those candidates to say, when I was in Detroit, I saw some real examples that
yeah.
have made an impression on
yeah.
them.
Yeah. Hmm. That would be great.
Okay. Peter, what's the question?
I think the question I would ask of each candidate is, to them, what does it mean to be an American? And has that changed over the years? Because I see that as a major subtext for this campaign.
How so?
Well, I think part of that is a point I raised earlier, is what level of assimilation or acculturation should we expect from folks? And I think it touches on a lot of issues, because I think there's a lot of debate about what level of assimilation or acculturation. And it touches on another issue I think it is very important. What level of self-policing should various communities do? That's very hot in the Islamic community now, is the whole notion of self-policing. I raise it constantly in the African-American community that external policing never is going to address crime. In my community, self-policing is the only thing where you'll make headway. But there's huge issues or concerns or questions about that. But I think these are subtexts that mm-hmm. go on, and they come out in that overall question of what does it mean to be American? And I'd really like to hear Donald Trump's answer to that and how it's changed over time. But I'd really like to hear Hillary yeah. Clinton's answer
right.
to that.
Yeah.
And does she think it's changed over time in a good or bad way?
This is a perfect moment for me to say that we have a series planned on that very question at the, I think it's the third week of October. We'll be talking about that. But we are going to ask people from a lot of different walks of life, different backgrounds, artistic pursuits, different ideas about what it means to be an American. Mm-hmm. So you're channeling the yeah. series that's coming up on that. Do you think you'd get a satisfactory answer, I guess, in the debate?
Well, I'll say no.
Yeah, you don't.
Yeah.
Why?
I'll say.
Jorge, why are you so sure? Why are you so sure you would not? Yeah.
Because I don't think either of the candidates, neither Trump nor Clinton, understand what it is to be an American.
Really?
I really wow. believe that. I really believe that.
What don't they understand about it?
Well, I listen to so much of what they say, and I read so much about what they say and what their backgrounds are, and I think that America is many steps ahead of them in terms of who we are and what America really looks like on the ground. And so that's where I think that an answer on that, I think, is going to go sort of to the lofty American ideals, which I think there's a little bit of fiction in that. And mm-hmm. I think if we're really going to be honest about where America is, America has undergone some changes that I think that we have not been prepared to acknowledge in terms of, you know, one in every three voters is going to be a person of color in this upcoming election. That's very, very different than where this country has been historically. And that is not part of the discourse and has not been part of the discourse. You know, and when we talk about immigration or this sort of racial change, we go back to this sort of, you know, the melting pot or the fabric and, you know,
and familiar, yes, kind of comfortable language.
Platitudes. Yeah, yeah. Platitudes. And we are not, I think, confronting the sort of dramatic demographic change that's taking place in America. So I don't think that the candidates would hit the mark on that.
Nashina, what do you think?
So I think they will each have a different answer, and they really, truly will believe that they are correct, and they'll be very different answers.
And they'll be wrong? Or
in their minds, they're going to sound right, and I think to the rest of us, they're going to sound wrong.
Wow. Peter?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Nashima, particularly her earlier comment that they'll tap dance around it. But I think we will get some indications. You know, I would ask a follow-up question. I would say, when does American exceptionalism become xenophobia? I'm a strong believer.
That's a good question.
I'm a strong believer in American exceptionalism. I think we are an exceptional country. But I do think it leads to xenophobia at some point. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
When you're saying, gee whiz, we have this wonderful system and this wonderful government and it's kind of magical and mystical, that it morphs into xenophobia. I want people to tease out where that line is, because I think there is a line. And I struggle with that all the time. As somebody who believes in American exceptionalism, but I get uncomfortable with the nationalism and the xenophobia.
I mean,
that
don't you think some of this is the exceptionalism looks like me? You know, individuals who say this is how to embody American exceptionalism, me and the people that look like me.
I don't think it does.
Carrie, I think that's all right as long as you understand that everybody has a right to say that about themselves.
Yeah.
Right? But it's when you take the next step and say, and then you have to be like me, where we get into trouble. But
yeah.
I just want to, you know, a follow-up and maybe a more specific and related question. In terms of this xenophobia question is about that fine line, I would ask the question about, you know, exactly how much time is it in the timeline of your immigrant history that you get to turn around and close the door on others? Is it, you know, is it a year? Is it one generation,
right.
two generations, three generations
right.
that you get to turn around and close the door on
But
others?
I think many people would say, we don't want to close the door. We just want to make sure that people that come through are willing to drink from the same water.
No, I think people are saying that we want to close the door.
I think some people are. I think some people, but I think other people are being misinterpreted and saying, if you come through the door, we want to make sure you are drinking from exactly the same pool, which is what, kind of our founding principles and ideals and the like. And I think some people really use that to keep folks out. I agree with that. And I think some people aren't using that to keep folks out.
Yeah, and that's what, Donald Trump is saying that right now. The sickness and the hatred, I think, is what he was talking about, and how, what he's suggesting is that immigrants have to ascribe to a specific set of ideals.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious to know who the drafters are going to be on those ideals.
I don't know if he's saying it's like Colin Kaepernick. I don't think anybody is saying he doesn't have a right to do what he's doing. It's just, is it advisable for him to be doing what he's doing? I think people aren't saying, I think people are saying that if you subscribe to a core set of ideals and beliefs, I don't think that should be a litmus test for coming into the country or being an American. I think that will just make America function better.
And I, what I would say is, looking at the suspect in the St. Cloud stabbings, who came to the United States as a 2-year-old, how exactly is that line of questioning going to happen with a 2-year-old child?
I wouldn't have any line of questioning. I was very clear. I don't think that should be a criteria for coming into the country or being a citizen. I don't think it should be. I think to the extent to which Donald Trump says that, he's wrong and misguided and un-American. I do think, however, for us to function, it is really important that we all adhere to a similar set of values and principles and the like. And to the extent to which we do that, our country will be stronger.
Hey, thank you all for, I know this could have gone on easily for another hour. Thank you for a really good roundtable. Nashina, Jorge, Peter, thank you. Good to have you here.
Support for NPR comes from Nexus, a provider of youth and family solutions. Offering Nexus Cares, a year-round support system available through Kindred Family Focus that makes the lives of children in foster care more hopeful and enjoyable. More at changingonelife.org.